Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we're slightly back together. Lauren and I are together. Hopefully things are not too echoey in my new apartment where we're recording. So we'll work on the acoustics here over time. Radha, is it sunny in San Francisco today?
I mean, it's sunny for San Francisco.
Right.
Right. Okay.
It's also not hot or humid. I don't know if that's good or bad. I kind of miss the summer humidity. It's so good for my skin. So less good for my hair. Oh, well.
Well, we have plenty of that in Washington. I got to tell you, what's not good for your skin is spending all of your time on airplanes between D.C. and California.
Sheet mask, Erin. Sheet mask.
I love sheet masks, but I refuse to do them on the actual airplane.
Oh, come on. Oh, like, well, anybody cares.
That is so weird. Anyway. Okay, what are we drinking this morning? Or actually late afternoon,
It's late ladies. Afternoon today. We're actually after 5. We are drinking some Saint Michel Rosé. It is dry, crisp, and elegant. Just like me.
Safeway's finest. I'm so glad we have this here. You have anything fun there, Radha? Do you have some pop? It's a little late for Pop-Tarts, so.
I don't. I, in fact, do have a pile of Oreos that I will work my way through throughout the podcast, so I feel like that's going to really keep things chugging along.
I can't wait for Trey to edit that sound out. Excellent. And we have with us back again from Brookings, Amanda Sloat. Hello, Amanda.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
Are you drinking anything fun?
I'm drinking a nice cup of British tea to get myself in the mood for our discussions.
Oh, well, right. Excellent. Well,
perfect.
Hold on to that for just a minute, because first we need to answer the Bombshell questions before I forget to ask them.
I'm so proud of you. All right. So Amanda has been a guest on our show before. I believe we were talking Turkey, literally last time, Turkey, Syria.
We were.
Okay. Well, we have a new set of Bombshell questions that I'm quite excited about. The first one being, what do you follow like a sport that is not a sport?
I follow the weather.
Yes.
I find being from the Midwest, it's a topic of constant conversation. Living in the UK for many years, it's a topic of constant conversation. Even at the beginning of this show, it's one of those nice things you want to check in with everybody on. I find I track weather in other cities. I track weather in cities where I'm going. And in the winter, I'm particularly addicted to the OPM app. Because even though being a Midwesterner, I find it ridiculous that Washington has snow days that give everybody days off from work. I will religiously refresh it to see what the status is going to be for the next day.
Do you have a viewpoint on relative humidity versus dew point as a measure of how humid it is outside?
Having spent a summer in Baghdad, I find the more interesting debate whether or not high humidity is worse than just really intensely high heat. Because I feel like once you get up to about 120 degrees, heat's just bad whether or not you've got humidity in there or not.
That is totally true, but the correct answer is dew point. So we'll come back to that in a future discussion.
Wow.
Okay, next question.
If you could pitch a show to Netflix, what would it be?
So I think Netflix should do a reality-based show on the International Space Station. I feel like if we are going to watch people in the Big Brother house, we're going to watch people out in the jungle on Survivor, I really would like to know what's happening in the space station. How are they sleeping? With whom are they sleeping? What are they eating? Who are they emailing? Because you know there's all sorts of interpersonal drama going on as they float past Earth.
Have you read Seven Eves?
I have not.
Okay, so
definitely do that and get back to us.
Definitely read it. Like, to be clear, I only liked like maybe the first third of Seven Eves. You could probably stop after that, but like it covers exactly this dynamic that you're speaking of with a little bit of like end of the world parts coming in to, you know, make everything interesting.
And a lot of like moon metals, because it's Neal Stephenson.
Unnecessary. Who is your favorite fictional or literary hero?
So I found in thinking about this, I was reflecting on all of my childhood reading and realizing there was actually lots of really good female characters in books. So I was thinking first about Laura Ingalls Wilder, but then thought, you know, she's a little less in favor at the moment with some not particularly positive comments about Native Americans and other minorities on the wilderness. I thought about Ramona Quimby. But then I decided I'm going to go with Nancy Drew because I feel like she was smart. She was resourceful. She had her boy, Ned, her girls, Bess and George.
In a blue convertible. I read a lot of Nancy Drew, which is not at all surprising.
Me too.
So
my favorites were the Nancy Drew Hardy Boy Super Mysteries, which combined the two and had this like undercurrent of romance between Nancy and Frank Hardy that Ned would always show up at exactly the wrong moment and interrupt.
I love that this is Ned. What you remember from these series.
All right, Aaron Stern.
Amanda, what is your favorite algorithm?
I think my favorite algorithm is Google Maps, which really is life-changing to be able to type in your destination and go. But I am sad that it is denying future generations the opportunity to wander around Europe with nothing but a map in a Lonely Planet guidebook to find their way. Because remember those maps, and they only had about 5 street names listed? And so you had to piece together where you were going without complete information.
Well, to get us in the mood, I, when I moved to London, had a giant A to Z, which I had to use to navigate the streets of London myself pre-Google Maps era, which if you ever are in London and you happen to be a native New Yorker, you'll remember that there is no grid system and nothing is parallel or perpendicular to anything else. So you're like, how is this? How did I get here? It doesn't even seem geographically possible, but it is.
That part's ridiculous. That's, you know, there's some real legibility issues. I want to call Jim Scott and have him explain London streets to me. But instead of doing that, we're going to talk about many other British things. I've got at least 3 British political developments on my mind. And Amanda, we can take these in whatever order you want. They are Brexit, of course, the Conservative Party leadership race, because Theresa May is finally stepping down. And last but not least, an upcoming state visit from our favorite president to the United Kingdom. What could possibly go wrong? So which of those shall we start with?
We should take them in the order that you listed them, I think.
All righty. Brexit. What's the deal with that?
The funny thing about Brexit is the more things change, the more things stay the same.
Exactly.
We've had an incredible amount of churn over the last couple of months, and we are still no closer to anything getting resolved. We are now approaching the 3rd anniversary of the Brexit referendum.
I read that when I was prepping, and I was like, 3 years? Are you kidding me?
My gosh.
3 years, and nothing is getting closer to sorted. So the UK has voted 3 times on Theresa May's deal with the EU that has failed to pass. The EU has extended the departure deadline twice. They just held elections to the European Parliament, which is a body that they plan to leave. And the long-suffering Theresa May has just announced her resignation date. And yet, despite all of this churn, we are still no closer to having any sort of resolution to the future of Brexit.
So we've discussed occasionally on the show the question of how much the resistance to Theresa May's proposed deal was about her versus the actual substance of the deal. And I think there's probably some not small amount of misogyny in the undercurrents of whether or not people actually disliked Theresa May or disliked her substance. Now that she is gone, I know that
she's not quite gone yet.
She wants, for undetermined reasons, to hang in there to welcome Donald Trump next week. And then once she has suffered her final misery and humiliation, she will finally exit stage left.
All right. But when she manages to exit whichever side of the stage she manages to get off, because who knows what's going on these days, is it any way possible that whoever picks this up would try again with effectively the same deal she had, just to see, like, you know, I'm not Theresa May, so could this possibly work under me?
Many of the people who are running to replace her are taking very much that approach. I think there is a lot of people that are unhappy with the deal that she negotiated. There are people that have faulted the way that she negotiated it, the red lines that she set out for herself. But the problem is that whoever replaces her as leader is going to confront the exact same situation. You have a parliament that is deeply divided and does not have a majority for any way forward. You have a population in the country that is deeply divided and does not even really agree amongst itself on the way forward. And you have European Union leaders that are extremely frustrated with negotiations and have been very clear that they are not prepared to reopen the withdrawal agreement and renegotiate. So notwithstanding all of the promises that are being made by these contenders to replace her, the situation on the ground is going to remain the same. And really, I think what's at the heart of of the resistance to her deal is this backstop for Northern Ireland. And that's going to be something that it's going to be very difficult to get EU leaders, particularly given their deference to the Irish, to budge on.
And I think, you know, one thing, correct me if I'm wrong, so this is not a call for new elections yet in the UK. It's just an internal leadership race. The Conservatives will maintain their current kind of majority-ish status, which means will they remain in, it's not quite coalition, but cohabitation with the DUP, with this Northern Irish Party as part of that? Or do we expect that to shift at all?
That's a great question. So you're absolutely right. Theresa May is stepping down as the leader of the Conservative Party, but she is going to remain as caretaker prime minister until her replacement has been named. So we are likely to see her as prime minister for at least the next 6 weeks or so. This is a contest internal to the Conservative Party. The way this works is people put themselves forward as candidates. They need to be formally nominated by at least two members of parliament. The MP from the Conservative Party within Parliament whittle it down to two members, and then paid up members of the Conservative Party, which is about 120,000 people, are the ones that end up casting a vote between the two. So I think in the near term, we will see a new leader emerge. And because the Conservatives still don't have a majority in Parliament, at least in the near term, they are going to have to stay in this supply arrangement with the Democratic Unionist Party. So that is going to hold for now.
Speaking of replacements, it's looking a bit like the Democratic primary field in terms of the number of folks who are interested. I assume that will not necessarily last for this entire span of the election, particularly since that will be narrowed down. But can you give us a sense of perhaps top contenders, but also like top types of contenders? What sort of positions are they trying to differentiate themselves with?
I can't believe there's so many of them who want this job.
Right. Why would you want this
job
now?
Seems totally miserable at the moment, but I guess Boris can't help himself. So Amanda, over to you.
That is right. I think there are currently at least 13 of them. Interestingly, the main thing that they are campaigning on is going to be their approach to Brexit and whether or not they are prepared to take the UK out of the European Union with no deal. One of the leading contenders, who I would expect to be in the final two and is quite likely to be prime minister at the end of this, is Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson, of course, used to be the mayor of London. He was briefly the foreign secretary of the UK, and he has come out as a leading champion of Brexit. Although apparently in his weekly columns that he writes for the Daily Telegraph, had written a pro and anti-Brexit and just decided, the story goes, the day before his column ran, which way he was going to want to go on this debate.
That's incredible.
He is now quite dug in on this. He also seems to be Donald Trump's favored candidate
when
Donald Trump was in. They both have kind of the crazy hair thing going on. When Trump was in London last summer, he was lamenting Boris Johnson, who had just stepped down as foreign secretary at that point, saying he thought he would be an excellent prime minister, in comments that he's repeated in a press interview before this trip. Another contender is Dominic Raab. He had been the Brexit secretary under Theresa May for a while, involved in these Brexit negotiations. Michael Gove is another person who's competing. We have a couple of women, including some who are calling simply for a clean Brexit and crashing out with no deal now. One of the ones that I find the most interesting, although probably will not progress, is Rory Stewart. Served in Iraq. He famously walked across Afghanistan and wrote a book about it, and he's now on a large walking tour in much of the UK. He is taking a much more measured approach to this question of Brexit and laying out, I think, very sensibly what the realities of this are. And then Jeremy Hunt, who's the current foreign secretary, is another contender that we are seeing.
I feel like Rory Stewart was sort of genetically designed to be my candidate of interest right now.
I stayed at his fort in Kabul once.
Did you?
Yeah, life is really weird sometimes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I agree that he's unlikely to be successful in this round, partially because he's making a great deal of sense. And he had actually spent a lot of time and effort essentially stumping for May's plan. With basically, it's like, guys, this is the plan. There's no magical better plan. Crashing out is a disaster. We have to do this and then work out the negotiations going forward. So I was reading a little bit about the paid up members of the Conservative Party. And as you might guess, they are not a uniform representation of the British public. They are significantly older and significantly more rural than the country as a whole. And so it'll be interesting to see kind of what, you know, who those, what that part of the electorate, a very small Conservative selectorate, will put forth here. When does that ballot go out, Amanda? Do you know?
I think likely in July. So Theresa May has not wanted the formal contest to replace her to start until Trump is wheels right. up. So it'll be a week before that begins. We need them to declare. They need to decide how they're going to whittle it down in terms of votes that they're going to take. And then it has to go out to the members. So no, in some ways, it's not entirely different from our primary system where we have a small number of people in Iowa standing in the corner of the gym. but for people there, I think you're absolutely right. It skews older, it skews more conservative, and it skews harder line in terms of Brexit.
And their election that selection process is different for the Conservative Party than the Labour Party, right?
That is a good question.
Yes.
But yes, I believe that is true. Because you're seeing, you know, divisions within the Labour Party with, you know, Jeremy Corbyn,
exactly.
being reflected by some harder line members. Yeah.
So you mentioned Donald Trump's visit. What, I mean, if we were doing pure, if you're, you know, writing a memo for an agency in the UK government, what would you tell them to expect from the upcoming visit?
I expect the unexpected always with with Donald Trump. I think that there's really three components to this. The first is the ceremonial, and I think quite frankly this trip is going to be heavy on ceremony and quite light on substance. The reason that Trump is going to Europe this week is to participate in the 75th anniversary commemorations of D-Day. So he will be participating in ceremonies with the royal family. He will be participating in the Normandy commemorations in France. Interestingly, and we can come back to this, he decided he did not want to overnight in France. He has preferred to go and stay in Ireland at his own golf course, which created a little bit of a kerfuffle with the Irish Taoiseach, who not surprisingly did not want to come pay homage to Trump at his hotel, preferred to meet with him in a castle. Trump not so big on the castle, so they're essentially going to have a brief bilat at the airport.
that's right. They're meeting like in the you know, the bar in Shannon or something.
At Shannon Airport.
Like so many of us have.
many of us, yes, have had pints of Guinness and coffees in Shannon Airport. So I'm trying to work out where exactly in that airport they are going to set up a meeting room. But it'll be very heavy on the ceremony. And as we've seen from Trump on Bastille Day commemorations and with Macron in France, his recent visit to Tokyo, Trump really likes the pomp and circumstance of all of this. So there will be a state dinner with the Queen. There will be tea with the royal family. So I think a lot of photo coverage of the ceremonial piece. Trump, interestingly, is bringing all of his children and apparently their partners to hang out with the Queen. So it's going to be a large family delegation that is going to be going. Second, on the policy side, if I was writing a memo for the president on this, I assume there would be discussions about Iran, questions about continued unhappiness by the Brits with American withdrawal from the JCPOA, American unhappiness with British efforts along with the French and Germans to set up this separate financial vehicle to do transactions with Iran. And then clearly, as we've seen, the two sides have different assessments of the threat stream in Iraq, with a British general coming out and publicly questioning what the Americans had decided on that. And then third, and most interestingly, I think, and what we're already seeing is going to be the degree to which Trump decides to interfere in British domestic politics. He's already repeated what he did last summer in terms of giving a very provocative interview to The Sun, which is the tabloid mm-hmm. newspaper in the UK. He has said that Nigel Farage, who leads the Brexit Party, which just won the European election, should be the one to negotiate Brexit. He's continuing to support Boris Johnson. And there are reports that Trump may have meetings with Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage while he is in London.
Oh, really? That's like incredibly inappropriate, right? I mean, am I?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm just, you know.
It is. Yeah, there's like weird precedents that you would could cite to say like, yeah, okay, that's how we've done things like that before. Like President Obama met with Ed Miliband in the White House, but like not that way. There's ways to do this. We have rules.
Well, and these aren't even leaders of the opposition party. These are leaders of the prime minister's own party who have been trying to unseat her. The opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, Vince Cable of the Lib Dems, they have both refused to attend the state banquet because they don't believe it's appropriate for Trump to be feted in this way. So it's him actively involving himself in the contest to replace Theresa May. To go back to the earlier point, it's I guess debatable whether or not this helps or hurts Boris Johnson in his desire to win over the support of these 120,000. If they like Trump, this may be beneficial to him. But it is interfering in Britain's domestic politics.
Friend of the show, Tom Wright, and also your colleague at Brookings, had a piece in The Atlantic that was pretty pessimistic in terms of talking exactly on this question of Trump's interference in British domestic politics and sort of setting the stage for, he described it as the lowest point in the UK-US relationship since Suez, which is, that's low. That was low, right? I mean, like those are two post-war, like all of the lows. As we kind of wrap up here, Amanda, do you have a sense on, you know, how things will work between the US and the UK going forward? I mean, is there a path toward getting on better footing? If, for example, Boris Johnson becomes, PM, I mean, I could see relations quote unquote improving, but that's because they have kind of shared kind of personal interest on certain questions. This is a very unusual relationship between the US and the UK, but it also has to be sustained by the individual personalities at work. Certainly we saw some of that drama with the Iraq war for certain, and the fallout, particularly in the UK over that, but give you a walk off here on kind of, how do things look going forward?
I think that's exactly right. And I think it really is one of the biggest challenges that we're facing with this Trump presidency is how do we preserve relations between countries, especially those that have been very close European allies of the United States for a long time, when we have a president that is dismissive of those alliances, that is taking a very transactional approach, and that is actively cheerleading a very hard Brexit and seeking to undermine the legitimacy of the country's prime minister. So I certainly think if Boris Johnson becomes prime minister, you will have warmer optics between the United States because it'll be moving the country in a direction that Donald Trump thinks he wants. I think a lot of the advice that he has been giving on Brexit simply does not reflect an understanding of what the facts are on the ground. Even if the UK ends up crashing out without a deal, the EU will require them to pay their bills to deal with the border in Northern Ireland. And really the crux of the issue on Brexit, as far as Trump is concerned, is he wants to negotiate a very good trading arrangement with the UK. Theresa May has been in a vulnerable position given Brexit, has wanted to show that she can negotiate these free trade agreements with other countries. Trump is likely to force the UK to make a number of concessions that are not going to be appealing to them, such as importing our chlorinated chicken, our genetically modified food, adjusting the pharmaceutical pricing by the National Health Service. And I think we're really seeing Congress, as we have in other foreign policy issues, really find its voice. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi did a trip recently to London, Dublin, Belfast, where she said very clearly that the U.S. Congress would not ratify a free trade agreement that in any way was damaging to the peace process in Northern Ireland. So I think we are likely to see a lot of these things continue to play out. And, the president certainly is entitled to express his view, but I think going beyond that and really mucking around in a lot of these domestic politics, especially the extent to which he's continued to humiliate and undermine Theresa May, as Tom laid out in his piece, is problematic and shameful for American treatment of one of our closest allies.
Okay, Amanda, before you go, about a week and a half ago, I believe you got to meet the Speaker of the House of Commons, And I really have to know, first of all, does he walk around saying "Orda" like all the time? Does he growl when he talks? What's he like? And then second of all, I want to make you tell the world what he said that Ed Balls said about you, which first of all, let's just remark on the fact that Ed Balls knows who you are. That's so lovely. And second of all, he said something very nice. So go ahead.
He did. I will start with the first part. So I was on a panel with Ed Balls at Harvard talking about Brexit earlier this year, and had said I would be very interested in getting Speaker Brookout to come to Brookings if he was in Washington. And Speaker Brookout told me when he got out of the vehicle at Brookings and then surprised me by announcing it in front of my boss and to the world from the stage at Brookings that Ed Balls had commended me to him, had said that I had a very good understanding of the European issue, and apparently reported that I had a brain the size of a planet.
Put it on a t-shirt.
That's so great. I just want everyone to Google Ed Balls. If you don't know who Ed Balls is, you need to Google Ed Balls, because he just makes like his existence and the existence of Ed Balls Day makes me very happy.
It really is an amazing story, bringing together two incredible characters in British politics. And I feel like being able to find something that can unite conservative and labor leaders on an issue such as this, my work in British politics really is done. Yes, Ed Balls famously tweeted out his own name, which has led to great hilarity. He also competed on the British version of the dancing show.
Dancing with the Stars?
Dancing with the Stars. Wow. The British version, Strictly Come Dancing. So he's a very colorful character. And his wife is Yvette Cooper, mm-hmm. who is still in the British Parliament and has been instrumental in some of the Brexit amendments that we have seen in the past. So lots of great intrigue with them. But no, I think that will remain my pinned tweet for all times. John Bercow was lovely. He's incredibly animated. He's got a fascinating backstory as well. The son of a London taxi driver, did not come up through Eton and Oxford and many of the formal schooling the way a lot of British politicians did. One of the things that I asked him during our session is whether he just had a particularly deep knowledge himself of British parliamentary procedure going back to 1604 precedents, or whether he just had exceptionally good staff who were doing a lot of this work for him. And the answer seems to be somewhere in between. But no, he was a lively personality and full of enthusiasm. So I would commend the video of that to your listeners on the Brookings site.
Thank you so much for joining us, Amanda. This is a real treat.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's stick with our European theme here for just a minute and move on to keeping up foreign relations. There were elections for the European Parliament, which I confess I did not track in great detail other than some of the UK results, which were largely consistent with Amanda's description of British politics. The two major parties did not do very well at all, Conservative and later Labour. The Brexit Party did very well, which I just can't even begin to handle the irony of the Brexit Party doing well in EU parliamentary elections. Did you guys have any other major takeaways as we were looking at these results across the continent?
So I will say that my one takeaway on this was that voter turnout was higher than it has been, I believe, since 1994. So more than 50% of the EU population voted. There was higher than predicted turnout in a bunch of countries, including Germany, Poland, Spain, Sweden, and France. And so there was, at least in this landscape with some fragmentation and a lot of competing interests, at least voter and general populist interest in having their voice heard, which is something.
Speaking of elections, though, you know who's going to have elections again?
Bibi Netanyahu.
Israel. So folks will remember we've talked about the Israeli elections a couple of times on this show. The last we spoke, Netanyahu was in the process of forming a coalition in order to continue to lead the government. However, he has been unable to actually form a coalition for a number of reasons we can get into. And instead of effectively having his government dissolved, more or less, like having like his caretaker status removed, he is instead dissolving the Knesset, first time ever happened in Israeli history. Not that Israeli history is that long in that respect, but first time it's ever happened. They'll have elections again in September-ish and likely not have a government formed until November. which is a fascinating turn in Israeli politics. And I think a lot of folks are saying, like, oh, well, gosh, could this possibly mean that Netanyahu will remain in charge? Is it possible he may be removed? I think that's up for debate. I think, obviously, Avigdor Lieberman is clearly seeing a political opportunity for himself in order to make a play for leadership of the more conservative coalitions. He's a secular nationalist on the right wing. But if I were a betting person, which I am, I would guess that we'll be back in this rodeo with Netanyahu in charge in November again, regardless.
Yeah, those two have a long history together, or not so together, as well. And I think, and it was Lieberman who pulled out of the potential governing coalition at the last minute, leaving Netanyahu with insufficient seats. Because the Likud party only won 35 seats in the election. There are 120 seats in the Knesset. And so he was really depending on a number of other parties to include both Lieberman's Secular Nationalist Party, which is largely dominated by Soviet emigres, Soviet Jews, who emigrated some time ago, but also by the really right-wing...
Ultra-Orthodox
parties. And it turns out those two segments of the right wing do not get along at all.
No.
Which is an interesting fissure in modern Israeli politics.
Lieberman was interesting on this. He basically, one of his conditions was to effectively require more young ultra-Orthodox men and women, I suppose, to be required to serve in the Israeli military, which right now they are largely exempt from being able to do so. But he put this up as his condition of joining the coalition, amongst other inside baseball political things.
Including civil marriage, I believe, which is an interesting issue in Israel.
And this was rejected. So this coalition fell apart. Interestingly, Netanyahu even approached the Labor Party, which is more or less gone and dead, or the kind of the centrist labor movement, in order to see whether or not they'd be interested. And like, no, that's not really workable for us.
It has happened in the past, but it has not happened recently with Netanyahu.
No. The question remains, in my mind, something that my colleague Alon Goldenberg has raised, is like the Palestinian Authority is in a world of hurt right now economically, but due to a number of recent withdrawals of assistance and other recent political issues that has caused them to have a lot of economic struggles. And that can't wait 6 months. There was an assumption that this election, once over, we would see some sort of resolution of a path forward on that front. But we can't wait 6 months, I don't believe, in order to actually have that resolution take place. They're going to have to have a change in policy there in some form, both the United States as well as Israel.
And I think that part of this, sort of returning to something that we talked about with Amanda, is that Trump and Netanyahu have had this sort of Trump has engaged proactively in supporting Netanyahu, and Netanyahu has touted his Trump relationships as a pro and some of the outcomes there. And so there is sort of this overlap with both Trump policies and with the overall plan for peace-ish in the Middle East, which looks like it may be delayed pending these elections as well.
Yeah, hilariously, Kushner showed up this week in order to brief the plan in the Middle East, right in the middle of this decision, which was just exceptional timing.
Yeah. In a totally different part of the world, there was some odd reporting, some very disturbing reporting coming out from East Asia, of late fallout to the Hanoi summit. Radha, what's the rumor that people are sort of reporting here?
So what was reported, and then, you know, we should be cautious on whether this or what actually happened, was that some of the diplomats, including the lead negotiator on the North Korean side, were executed due to the failure of North Korea and the U.S. to reach any sort of meaningful agreement, sort of the failure of the summit. Now, it's not totally clear whether this is true, and it came from a sort of single source reported into South Korean media that then got broader attention, and there has been discussion that some of the people who were reported executed turned up looking alive and well next to Kim Jong-un. But there does seem to be some North Korean fallout and displeasure with the way the negotiations turned out.
Yeah, I think regardless, and Secretary Pompeo said this himself, there will be a new set of negotiators on the North Korean side in any future engagements. I was in South Korea about a month and a half ago, and that was very much the tenor there. This rumor was floating around at the time as well. But the fact that those negotiators are out and the new negotiators will be in regardless of the circumstance, that is all clear. It's just a question of who and what happened. But the fact that we are even contemplating this, I think, says a lot about the nature of this kind of regime and the potential for a long-term political deal with them beyond the bounds of the nuclear deal or a nuclear deal.
Radha, there were many trade developments this week. Again, I did not expect this segment to be quite so, you know,
fulsome
when we started it.
It is taxing. I can just keep going.
Whoa. Our campaign to refer to tariffs as trade taxes continues. And the administration's campaign to add new states being taxed also continues. So
yeah.
Apparently we're going to put new tariffs on Mexican goods, by which, and we mean all of them, until they stop
the
illegal immigration.
Correct.
At the same time, we're putting forward the USMACA. This all makes sense.
We're very cross with Mexico regarding the southern border. So just as catch up for everyone, President Trump tweeted that we were going to institute a 5% tariff on all things from Mexico starting June 10th. That tariff would go up each month until it hits 25%. This is a clarification from the White House on what the, quote, policy plan was. And Mick Mulvaney confirmed it as we recorded today, which is Sunday, sort of when he did the round of morning shows, talked about it. So the bottom line is the president decided to use the International Emergency Economic Powers Act.
We just talked about that last time.
I know. It's very exciting. And in response to that, I had kind of been reading about it just out of, you know, idle curiosity and boredom, as one does.
Uh-huh.
So it turns out the point of this was to allow the president authorities to impose, like, sanctions and financial penalties on adversaries. So it's not like the other tariff authorities that we have been using for folks who might remember that Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act, which is this Cold War statute that gives you some tariff rights, or Section 301 of the Trade Act. That's what we used on China. So those are things that actually give the president authorities to tariff. This is like more like you can impose financial penalties, sanctions, like this sort of thing. We've used it. Jimmy Carter used it against Iran after the hostages. It's not historically been thought of or used for this type of tariff taxation purpose, which is generally thought to be reserved for Congress to decide absent major national security needs.
Well, that's going to be fun to sort out.
Right. Well, so it turns out this Carter application, if you think about it in the authority sense, like, is this an expansion of authorities in the way we sometimes do for use of military force issues? It's a pretty big expansion from what has been historically thought, though the language on this IEEPA from the Supreme Court decision when Carter imposed sanctions is pretty broad. So I don't think you've got a great court remedy. So short of Congress explicitly taking back saying tariffs don't fall under this, there's not much that can happen. And in the meantime, of course, it just has huge economic impact because after China, who we're now taxing a lot, Mexico's our next biggest trading partner. And it's actually much more integrated into sort of U.S.
Things go back and forth across the border, which I think people don't always realize.
It's very heavily integrated into supply chain. So there's this sort of direct effect to consumers, like consumers in America just buy directly a lot of Mexican stuff. There's this supply chain effect, which is, you know, our supply chains are very integrated with Mexico. And then there's this retaliation problem where, like, Mexico actually buys a lot of stuff from us, too.
Right.
And if they are, not just going to sit there like little lumps and actually want to push back on this, then there are serious tariffs and costs that can be imposed, especially in the ag industry. So given all of that, it's not totally clear it's going to have much effect on the border.
Well, and that's the other thing, right? And this we see this happening on several issues. And as you know, I have never followed trade particularly carefully. One reason is that we used to try to keep trade issues or economic issues somewhat distinct from security issues, right? And so we sometimes other partners wanted them to be integrated, and we typically kept them a little bit more separate. It strikes me as certainly unusual and maybe really a bad idea to basically cross the streams, you know, in terms of immigration policy and, you know, these tariffs. I mean, to punish Mexico when what you want them to do is actually secure their southern border so that there are fewer immigrants from Central America coming through Mexico into the United States eventually. It's a very, it seems like a very crude instrument for what's otherwise a complex problem.
Right. It's a pretty crude instrument. It's also not totally clear given the incentives of people to try to go through, like, we invest a lot in our border, and according to the president, a lot of people still get through, right? So even if the Mexican government had an official policy with sufficient incentives for migrants, they will still be getting through. So it's not clear, like, this is the right policy tool to be using. It's not like a lack of political will necessarily that is generating immigration flows into the U.S. And so given that, it's not clear this is the most useful way to induce changes in that. But it is costly, so the markets aren't terribly happy about it. Everyone's a little bit concerned about the abuse of powers, and the companies are a little confused about what's going to be covered. So it should be fun.
And so is new NAFTA, like, moving forward, or is it dead on arrival? Or, like, how are these things related? Or, like, how do you do both at the same time?
Well, you can't, really. I mean, you could have an agreement and then claim that Mexico is in violation of the agreement and that for national security reasons you're imposing this tax. But given that we don't actually have an agreement and nobody's actually signed off and agreed on it, it's not clear that Mexico would want to sign off on this agreement in a state of the world where the U.S. can just arbitrarily impose tariffs.
So then, I know the answer to this, but I'm just going to ask it baldly. Why did the Trump administration notice you smack it to Congress, which is effectively them saying, like, hey, we're probably in, like, the next 30 days going to send this to you?
Well, there's a question of process, which is how much people thought that the president would actually declare that we would do this, given that it's both not a good idea and may or may not be legal. So there might have been a little bit of a surprise factor on that. But I think the other piece is, I think the Trump administration is hoping to use this as a negotiation tactic to get Mexico to cave on some border issues and then follow it up with this trade agreement that'll solve all the problems. Since it's, like, the same government that we're just about to, like, punch in the face and then ask if they would please, you know, do a bunch of nice stuff for us, it doesn't seem like that's the best negotiating strategy. But, you know, I didn't write the art of the deal, so I don't know.
That's fair.
Okay, I know there were other Huawei developments, but we're going to catch those, I think, the next time around. And we'll shift gears a bit to White House mayhem, which I guess we have an update from last week, which was we had quite a tirade about these possible war crime pardons.
Yes.
Which we all remain, I think, quite incensed about. But for now, they have not happened. So there was no Memorial Day pardoning or reprieve for these accused military members. I guess it remains that the Trump administration could sort of do this at any point, but there was whatever, you know, pomp and ceremony they had planned for Memorial Day weekend did not happen. So we at least have that to celebrate.
I mean, so that is still on hold, but it's still, at least as far as we can tell, under review by the Justice Department, which would be the authority and saying, like, okay, here's the pardons. You can go sign them, sir. For a point of clarification and also a bit of mayhem, the case of Edward Gallagher, the Navy SEAL that was accused of any number of interesting, horrible crimes, is actually still ongoing. He has not been convicted. However, he was recently released from pretrial holding, one reason being that his prosecution was using some interesting technology to track the emails of the defense as well as a reporter. So just generally, when you're doing war crimes prosecutions, it seems as though you should keep it on the up and up, particularly when you have some spectacularly good evidence. Why on earth they did this, I don't know. But there we are.
But the other mayhem from the White House this week, and this time it's directly from the White House military office, as many of us have been following the last couple of days, is following what was otherwise a totally uneventful trip for the president to Japan. I mean, almost no headlines, not a significant amount of coverage. I don't even know what Melania wore. Like,
he went golfing and they took a selfie with Abe?
Yeah,
I
mean, like, totally straightforward head of state, you know, kind of stuff. He met the new emperor, all the good things. But it turns out that the White House military office asked probably Seventh Fleet or at least somebody in the Navy in Japan to make sure that the USS John McCain was, quote, kept out of sight. And this has now spiraled into who knew what when, and do you have their emails, and, you know, who authorized what, and all of the things. The Navy basically tried to dissemble and had a very clever initial response, which was true in exact fact, but otherwise completely misleading.
Was technically true.
Technically
true, not so much really accurate, and was the first time that the Army Chinfo account had tweeted in like ages.
The Navy Chinfo account.
Navy Chinfo account had tweeted in ages and then had to not quite retract, but like give a lot of clarifying context to the original tweet.
And so on the one hand, this is sort of just like petty stuff, and it's the sort of thing that definitely goes on for head of state, you know, visits and trying to get every, like, wouldn't it be awkward? I mean, I can actually imagine being the like junior staffer being like, oh God, he's not going to want a photo op in front of the McCain, right? But it's sort of how did that not get squashed like way earlier in the process, but also how freaking politicized is our military? Like, how politicized are all of these?
Also, am I right in remembering that the McCain was one of the ships that had a major collision?
And yes, that's why it's there. That's why it's been
while. So it couldn't really be moved, but also the folks on it have had a kind of a bit of a time.
Bit of a time, yes. I think, so Shannon, there was a piece out in, I believe, Reuters today with some clarification from the Washington Post saying that Shanahan has not only gone back to the White House military office saying, like, don't politicize our military, which, like, Waymo has very little to do with the overall politicization of the military, but leaving that aside.
Yeah.
However, he's also considering guidelines to go out, I'm not really sure in what fashion, but effectively to address this issue of, like, why was this not quashed right away? Why was Shanahan not told right away? Like, there's a cultural issue here that I think is really awkward to wrap your arms around. Like, yeah, it's awkward when the commander-in-chief could be possibly put in an awkward situation. However, this is obvious and blatant politicization of the military. Why was this not raised up to the highest levels quite quickly to be done away with and, you know, not to be shown to be not tolerated?
Yeah, that gets into a big Navy culture question that we're going to need definitely more than that bottle of wine and certainly more time than we have here to dive into. So on the one hand, this is a little bit of a mountain out of a molehill. On the other hand, it is just emblematic of some really serious issues, both in terms of civil-military relations, but also in terms of some unit cultures that I think we'll continue to keep eyes on. But I would like to talk about pop culture, because Radha has a pop culture.
Guys, I have pop culture. Guys, I watched the show Good Omens.
Wow.
I watched it too. How many episodes did you watch?
Two.
Me too. So I will say that basically it turns out that I'll watch David Tennant in anything. That's pretty much I'm at.
Wait, is he the former Doctor Who one?
Yes.
Or the one, okay, yes. I liked him and I also
He's not the former Tony Blair one.
That's what I was going to say. I was like, oh, I know who both of, they've seen both of these guys before, which like almost never happens to me. So my takeaway was I felt like the show, if it was just those two guys talking all the time, would be awesome. But then there's like all this other stuff and it's really weird.
It's Neil Gaiman.
It's probably not my jam, but I watched two episodes and I felt like I was like on top of the pop culture situation.
I'm very proud.
It's good. I'm proud of you. I also saw Rocket Man, which I recommend to folks if
Do
you like Elton John.
Really?
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I don't know if I saw, maybe I saw a fake Twitter thread about it.
How much singing of it is?
Lots.
Is there?
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it is.
I definitely saw a fake
thread. It will definitely be like turned into like a Broadway musical like in 6 months. Like it was like totally written. But Taron Egerton, who you may know from The Kingsman and who should have been Han Solo, is amazing in it and is very, very good. So I will say that. Also, Archer started this week.
Oh.
I have not seen it yet, but it's like set as like Space Archer 1999.
Amazing.
That so makes sense.
I will definitely binge watch that with a large amount of alcohol at some point in the future.
I think everyone in the world knows that I'm rereading Wolf Hall. Actually, just finished rereading Wolf Hall, so I need to start bringing out the bodies again. It just makes me so happy to go home and like chat with Thomas Cromwell and like just be his best friend while I'm reading.
Oh, but now that you say that, I should totally reread Wolf Hall.
It's great.
And by reread, I mean listen to it on audiobook, which is delightful because the readers have British accents. The whole thing is really an
I started rereading it because I've been in a book rut and I can't find anything I like. And I was like, well, we might as well do Wolf Hall.
Might as well do. And actually, now that I've read it multiple times, like the beginning few chapters, you're like, who the hell is talking? They only refer to this person as he. It makes a lot more sense now.
Oh, yeah. It's just always Thomas Cromwell.
Oh, God. Before we go,
please, you know that the Spanish princess is keeping up, guys. Okay. The costuming is excellent.
Excellent. Good to know.
Before we go, I think this is, yeah, we won't do any episodes until my annual conference. The CNES annual conference is on June 14th. I will be moderating a panel with Senator Chris Murphy and Senator Josh Hawley, which is kind of exciting. More exciting is we have a panel on US-China relations called Conscious Decoupling. And I am so excited about that title. I think I've only gotten away with it because not everybody understands what I'm referring to. So
perfect. Well, yeah. They don't listen to the podcast either, so we'll be in great shape.
Yep.
So wonderful. It's so good to see you, ladies. We'll see everybody else here again soon. Bye.